Good evening, everyone. There was once a monk in the monastery who seemed to get along really well with everyone. He seemed to be he was very quiet. And whenever there was any kind of trouble, he seemed to always disappear. And if you asked him to do something, he'd always be willing to do it. And if there was ever any difficulty with anyone, he was always very deferring, respectful to anybody who came his way. And so he lived very harmoniously in the monastery. And the abbot noticed this. And so the abbot thought, this is interesting. So he gave him a new job at the monastery. And that job was to be the produce buyer. To go to town, to the produce stands, produce market, and buy the vegetables, produce, for the monastery each week. And he was given an allowance. This is how much money you have to buy the produce the monastery needs for the week. So Monday he would go into town. And it turned out that the merchants in the produce market in that town were famous all over the land for their fierce bargaining, or their fierce attempts to kind of jack up the prices as far as they could get away with. So this monk went to town to buy produce, and he said, "You know, how much is the potatoes?" And they gave a price, and he gulped, and okay, and so he gave him the money, and then he had no more money to buy anything else, and he came back to the monastery with 10 pounds of potatoes, whatever, and well, this is what I got with the money. And the abbot said, oh. And so they had potatoes Monday night. And then there was no more produce the rest of the week. And the monks were all, no one complained, of course, but they were all quite hungry at the end of the week. Next Monday, he went to town again, same allowance, and he realized that didn't go very far. So he didn't just take the first offer of potatoes that came his way, but he checked out a few different ones and found a place that was a little bit cheaper. And he was able to have enough produce to last through Tuesday. And he realized, this is not going so well. So then he gulped the following week, and he said, oh, that's a bit much for us. Couldn't you please maybe lower the price a little bit? And the merchants roared back, no, don't you know how much work it takes, how much it costs us to buy these from the farmers? We cannot. Okay. And our wonderful harmonious monk brought back another 10 pounds. It lasted only a day or so. But he was getting more and more hungry, and so were the other monks. And slowly, he learned that he couldn't be so subservient, he couldn't be so acquiescent, couldn't be so kind of getting along, but he had to somehow meet those big, tough, bargaining merchants at their own game. And he had to be able to say no, bargain back and forth, and threaten to walk away, and hold his ground, and bit by bit, he learned how to be in conflict. And of course, in the bargaining world of the marketplace, that bargaining was the expected language. And in fact, in some places in the world, if you don't bargain, sometimes it's considered a little bit disrespectful if you just give them the price. So they think it's kind of odd. So he learned how to be in conflict in this relatively safe place, in the produce market. So what happens, I think, maybe all too often in Buddhist circles, is Buddhist practitioners, in one way or the other, tend to become like that monk. And they tend to be a little bit conflict aversive or conflict reluctant. And a little bit it is because in Buddhist circles, the idea is to kind of be kind, be friendly, kind of learn to let go, be at peace, be calm. And those kinds of values, as important they are, as they are, can lend itself to people thinking that, you know, that they shouldn't be in conflict, or if there's conflict, there's something wrong. And so if there's conflict, let's just get out of the way, or let's kind of, oh, okay, whatever you say is fine, and let's not cause any problems here. And it's not healthy to do that. Part of a mature spiritual practice, I believe, is to learn how to be comfortable to be in situations that could be called conflict situations. Learn how to be comfortable, in a sense, willing to stand in a place of conflict. Maybe you don't feel like you're in conflict with anybody, but they feel like they're in conflict with you. And it's very tense to feel the anger and the hostility or the differences of opinion. I think it's, you know, almost, it's probably best to take it, say it's built into human life to assume there's going to be conflict. And then the question is, how do we relate to conflict? And when we have a Buddhist community, sooner or later there's going to be conflict in the Buddhist community, as far as I can tell, in all communities. And it's not the health of a community, or health of a Buddhist community, that's probably any community, is not the presence or absence of conflict, but rather is whether people are willing to meet the conflict in healthy ways. And I've been in Buddhist communities where they were unwilling to meet the conflict in healthy ways, sometimes by denial, sometimes by power, you know, power plays, sometimes by rationalization. Sometimes a great one is to say, oh, there's no problem here, you're the one who has the problem. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that in Buddhist communities where it's very easy sometimes for a teacher, like an abbot of a monastery who has certain authority, to look down at, you know, a new student and say, oh, there's not a problem here. You have, you know, it's your problem. You're supposed to go back to the cushion and meditate on this. And I've seen people who've done that, sometimes for years, think, oh, it's my problem, it's my problem, it's my problem. And it turned out it was the abbot's problem. The abbot was doing something outrageous. And in fact, but kind of putting up this mirror, saying, oh, no, you know, I'm the wise person, and you're just a fool, and you need to go back and kind of figure it out on your own. So there's many mechanisms by which in Buddhist communities people try to avoid conflict. In a community like ours, where it's so informal, it could be just disappearing. Some people just go away. They're, well, I'm not going to be there anymore. There's going to be conflict with someone. Another is to just kind of hide in the back corners and kind of avoid people. I'll come in, be very quiet, but I don't have to talk to them or work with them. Sometimes it's by assigning blame, kind of, you know, blaming other people for all the difficulties that exist. You got, you know, sometimes it comes right my way in the sense that, especially I see it on retreat, where someone is maybe in conflict, or, you know, feel some tension around someone else, some problem with someone else, and now they come to me and say, "You have to fix that problem. That person is, you can't believe what this person is doing." And sometimes the person is doing something inappropriate. But sometimes the person's not really doing anything inappropriate. It's kind of hard for me to go tell them to do something different. But rather the first person's uncomfortable around the second person. And because of the discomfort, kind of blames them for the problems. Says, you've got to go do something about that person and fix that person's for me. And so I've seen, you know, people kind of an unwillingness to look at their part, what their contribution is to the situation. The noisy meditator next to you is a classic one. People will come to me and say, "This guy, you know, he has this Velcro jacket. You know, he seems to have to open, rip it open in the middle of the sitting. Will you please fix this person for me?" Now, you're not supposed to have Velcro jackets in the meditation hall. That's true. But but it's not necessarily a spiritual problem. And so, you know, so generally on retreat, I'll say, tell the person, I think, why don't you work with a little bit with the sound and all that? And usually what happens after a few days, the person comes back and says, oh, actually, you know, now the person does it and it doesn't meet anything. There's no hooks, no resistance, no assigning a meaning, no self-righteousness in me that encounters that sound. It just kind of seems to go right through me. And in fact, sometimes people say, oh, that kind of sound, whatever it is, it's not just always Velcro, but other things. They say, oh, and now it's my mindfulness bell. whenever I hear it, it reminds me to be mindful, and I'll miss it if it goes away. So this idea of kind of, sometimes people aren't willing to look at their own part and they kind of assign blame elsewhere. Sometimes in spiritual circles, people will put the community or the teacher or other people up on a pedestal. And luckily our pedestal here is kind of low. So you know, I can't fall that far. But you know, if I'm on a pedestal, that you know, there's all this projection that goes on, and you expect the person to be just completely pure and perfect in every possible way. And then at some point, there's some kind of something doesn't quite jive, and maybe the teacher farts, or you know, it could be something else, and I had someone once distressed with me because I mentioned that I had I was in conflict with someone else. No one other person knew, someplace in a different place. And the person was so distressed that I should be in conflict with anybody. You know, it must be some personal failing of mine. You know, I'm supposed to be up in, you know, like riding on a cloud and just somehow manage to negotiate life without any kind of problems at all. So, and so then the result of that kind of projection, that kind of expectation, is sometimes tremendous anger. People feel let down. Oh, what, you know, it's kind of like the pendulum swings then. And so that also is a source of conflict sometimes. In our community, like here, where there's a lot of people who volunteer, we have a lot of volunteers who help in all kinds of ways. And generally people volunteer because this is valuable, something important, it has some importance for them. But as with any community, there can be differences of opinion, there can be ways in which people sometimes make mistakes and overlook each other, sometimes unintentionally, and sometimes there's intentional movements of ill will that go on. People say mean things to each other or something. It can happen in any community, it could happen here. And so my measure of a healthy community is not the presence or absence of conflict, not the presence or absence of difficulties, but rather the willingness to meet those and engage in them in a healthy way. It's the engagement in them that makes health, not the presence or absence of them. So there has to be a willingness. There was one Buddhist community I was involved in that had trouble with conflict. You know, the whole community was kind of conflict aversive. It was a whole culture of it. And they began, after it took many years, but eventually they realized they had this difficulty. And so they invited in a person, a woman, who was a kind of a really good conflict coach, kind of a mediator, facilitator, and kind of did conflict resolution kind of trainings. And she came and she said, "Oh, conflict. Conflict makes me happy." And some of the people at the place almost fainted. What? I mean, it wasn't even that dramatic, but they were kind of, what? That kind of woke them up. What? Makes you happy? We're so afraid of it here. And the reason she saw it, she made her happy, is she sees it as an opportunity. It's an opportunity not only to kind of, you know, make some resolution, but when there's conflict, there's an opportunity for deeper understanding. Deeper understanding and growth within oneself, and deeper understanding and growth within the community. And now, some conflicts that arise are kind of messy to begin with. Some, you know, happen from misunderstandings or something. Some are pretty messy to begin with. Or they get into it because people kind of, the people's best of who they are somehow was on vacation that day. And so people say things they wish they didn't say, or, you know, act in ways they wish they didn't act. And so, of course, all these things can happen. And just to underscore what I've said many times now, it's not the presence or absence of conflict or difficulties or making a fool of yourself, or, you know, which is a sign of health. It's the presence or absence of a willingness to meet it and engage in it, to take the time to stop, say, okay, and name it. There's conflict here. The first place where I saw conflict being dealt with in a very healthy way was a community, a commune kind of, back in the 70s, named The Farm in Tennessee. There were 800 people who lived there. It was run by a man, or kind of headed by a man named Stephen Gaskin, who whose three teachers, spiritual teachers, was his Marine sergeant, I guess a Marine Corps sergeant that he had trained under, Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master in San Francisco, and LSD. And he led a whole group of hippies from Haight-Ashbury to Tennessee to start this commune. And when they got to Tennessee, it didn't really work so well anymore to use LSD as a spiritual vehicle. Somehow Tennessee didn't quite, you know, allow it. And he spent a year in jail. So they had to find some substitute to LSD. And the substitute they found, they claimed, was as effective as LSD, was telling the truth. Isn't that something? It's telling the truth. And so I ended up one January kind of passing through and stopped for a few days and stayed for 4 months because the truth-telling in that community just blew me away. And what happened over the years they were there, they developed the capacity to stop and tell the truth to each other, talk to each other about difficulties that arose. And they developed kind of a radar. As soon as there was even subtle conflict in the community, tensions within the community, they would stop and say, let's talk about this. And of course, if you've never stopped and talked about tension or problems before, it might take a long time the first time. And in fact, that happened there. The first conversation sometimes would take hours until they had some resolution. But as they got better and better at this, sometimes the conflict was handled really quickly. And sometimes I saw actually, sometimes it just someone would smile and say, oh yeah, thank you for the reminder. Yeah, we did it again. And they kind of knew. It didn't take much once you kind of have worked out the parameters and understanding. And this willingness to stop when there was a feeling of tension or discomfort in the community was really inspiring for me. And after I left there, I tried for a long time to look for another community that had the same degree of honesty, same degree of kind of stopping for difficulties and working it out, however long it took. I had one, about 10 years ago, a little more, when I was at San Francisco Zen Center for a while, I had conflict with someone at a meeting. We had an ongoing meeting once a week or something. And meetings are some of the most difficult places for me personally. And, in terms of conflict and knowing how to work with it, sometimes meetings, Buddhist teacher meetings particularly. So it's one of my growing areas. And anyway, I was in these meetings. And one meeting, another fellow and I had some difficulty, some tension between us arose in the conversation. So I went home and reflected. And the first thing I reflected was what was my contribution to that difficulty. And then I saw that I actually had spoken in ways maybe they weren't good, or I hadn't listened properly or something. I forget what it was, but it was enough so that the next week, before the meeting started, I saw him. I said, oh, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you too. Mm-hmm. And he said, he got to the punch before me. And he said, I guess that's the wrong expression, but for what I'm trying to talk about. But he beat me to it, and he said, I want to apologize for, you know, how I talked last week. And I said, but I was going to apologize. And so it was really kind of a really wonderful thing. Both of us had done the reflection and see how both of us contributed to the difficulty, and both of us apologized. And I've seen that apology, even when 99% of the responsibility is the other person has done something wrong, that even if you're done 1% that you can apologize for, being willing to apologize can create a very different conversation where people don't get so defensive, where people can soften a little bit and be willing to kind of start saying, oh, okay, well, if you see it that way, then let me tell you my part. You know, then I was responsible a little too. It's certainly possible that if you apologize that people will take advantage of you, you know, and kind of just kind of say, well, yeah, you shouldn't have done that, leave it at that. But I've actually never seen that for myself. I've never encountered that. I've seen that if I take responsibility for my contribution, even if it's very small, that it actually seems to create a better situation, atmosphere for having a serious conversation about what needs to be talked about. And so this idea of kind of going away for a while and reflecting about how it is for me is a very important process that I like to do. And I can certainly make mistakes in the moment, but then usually I'm quite motivated by the mistakes I make because it kind of hurts. And motivated by that kind of feeling of remorse to reflect and think, what did I do here? What did I say? How did I say it? What didn't I understand? What was my projections? Or what was my... So all these things I do that I look at and try to reflect on. I prefer to do that before I go back and engage the person. I think it's, you know, generally, and it's not always the right policy, but it's kind of my first thought is, when and how to go back to a person I'm in conflict with and talk about the conflict, as opposed to let's just kind of pretend it's not there, or hope that it's going to go away nicely sometime. Because I really believe that it's a growth experience to engage in conflict. I feel there's a great opportunity to meet some person in a deeper way. I've been in many situations of conflict where we've taken the time to talk about it and work things out, and through that process I felt much deeper connection to the other person than I did otherwise. There have been people who I didn't like at first, just because, you know, they're not likable and whatever, you know, in my mind. And then I had some conflict and then sat down and talked about it and began understanding who they were in a deeper way and got to really appreciate them a lot from doing that process. For me, I would like to believe that the process of meditation prepares us to be in conflict in healthy ways. And not only that, but the process of meditation teaches us that it's important to be willing to go into conflict. Because in meditation, we're willing to face ourselves. We're willing to do that within ourselves. People are often in conflict with themselves. And so we're willing to sit with our own suffering. We're willing to sit and feel what's going on here. And to the degree to which there's some softening of the heart, some relaxing and letting go, we begin seeing how conflict or tension that we carry and hold is an irritant. It causes even more suffering, causes problems for us. We can feel the way we get defensive. We can feel the way in which we get offensive and blame, and how it just feels off. It feels wrong to do it. Mindfulness makes us very sensitive to these things. And so with that deeper sensitivity, I think there's hopefully a greater sense, something has to be dealt with here. Running away, pretending it's not there, doesn't feel right anymore. It feels like maybe kind of a shutting down or kind of a numbing, or, you know, it's okay, I'm happy, you know, I'm not in conflict with this person, but every time I see I'm not dealing with the conflict, I'm just avoiding the person, but every time we pass each other by from a distance, there's a kind of a feeling of, I hope the person doesn't see me or, you know, do something, you know, kind of a little bit discomfort. And my hope is that anyone who does a mindfulness meditation practice becomes intolerant of staying tense. That's my hope. That anybody who does mindfulness practices sooner or later become intolerant of staying tense. So that if you get tense, that this is something to pay attention to. This is something to bring your attention to and work with. And hopefully, if it involves interpersonal issues, the other people are willing to engage you as well, to be in conversation. Sometimes people are not the other party, and then you have to know how to work with that. Maybe then you have to just work with it within yourself. But if you can't work with it in yourself, but if the person is willing to engage in it, then something hopefully productive can happen. And it's a skill. It takes a lot of skill to know how to work through conflict, and some of that skill is learned by trying. So maybe you'll fail a few times. Some of it's learned by taking classes and reading books about it and learning some of the basic ideas of how to engage in conflict. What I thought I'd do is read to you. This is called the Ethical Principles and Procedures for Grievance and Reconciliation at the San Francisco Zen Center. So they have this beautiful document that they felt they had to, because of conflict in that community, they felt they had to kind of put something in writing and get a collective agreement. And so the second half of the document is what to do when there's grievances and how to go about approach reconciliation. And it says this. In Zen Center, they follow the Bodhisattva path. So the Bodhisattva path is our heartfelt response to suffering. Turning away or skimming over suffering through silence, rationalization, assigning blame, minimizing, feeling self-deprecating guilt, or not listening deeply to it, to its causes and conditions, are all steps directed away from the Bodhisattva path itself. Furthermore, avoidance is a condition for additional suffering. Thus, when a conflict, grievance, dissonance, or violation of the precepts arises in our interpersonal relationships, it is essential to attend to it fully. Personally, this involves waking up to our own contribution to the suffering in these situations through understanding our reactions, emotions, and attachments. So first, we start with ourselves. Even if you feel like you're being attacked, it's always good. Start with yourself. What's going on? Do it deeply. Then interpersonally, this involves taking the time to discuss the conflict with the other parties involved in an attempt to clarify the actual causes, conditions, feelings, and responses that come together in the situation. Although no fixed procedures for informal conflict resolution exist, the suggestions and procedures that follow are intended to give all persons involved in a dispute a chance to be fully heard in an environment of respect and kindness that flows from knowing that there is no fundamental difference between us. Stating the actual. So number one, the first thing to do is stating the actual. And I call this practicing mindfulness out loud. Because mindfulness is not interpreting what your experience is. Mindfulness is saying, this is what the experience is right now. If you say, you really blew it. That's so general. It doesn't really help the conversation. If you say, when you promised to bring the material to the event, and I was counting on you, and you didn't come with it, I felt hurt. That's a big difference, So he's kind of saying, "This is what the experience was, and this is how it was for me to experience it." There's no assigning blame. There's no interpreting it. There's no demand. I think it has to be different. Just saying, "This is the experience I had," and a lot of mindfulness training on the cushion, in and of itself, outside of conflict, is learning how to separate out the interpretation of an event from the event and how it's experienced much more directly and immediately. So that training of separating out the interpretation from how it's experienced directly is very, very important skill to have in being able to enter into a conflict resolution procedure. This was my experience. This is what happened. Once I was, when I was a graduate student, I was a TA for two professors, two different classes at the same time, same semester. They thought, oh, we'll share Gil. He'll do half, for each. It was a setup for problems. Because they each expected me full time or something, And so they all wanted so much from me. And I forget what happened, but for some reason I got furious with one of the professors. And he happened to be the chair of the department, my department, where I was trying to graduate from. And he was just, I was really furious somehow. I felt really disrespected or discounted in some important way. And so I knew that I had to say something to him. And I knew, for some reason, I had to do it right away. I didn't go away to clear first. So I was actually kind of a little bit shaking in talking to him. But I had enough sense to just stay and say, when this happened, when this event happened, I felt really hurt and felt really angry. I didn't say, I'm angry with you. I said, I felt really angry. And because of the way I said it, I wasn't saying anything about him. He didn't have to get defensive. And he then kind of entered into a conversation with me about it, and it resolved itself relatively quickly. So here in the Zen Center, they call it stating the actual. Here at IMC, we might call practicing mindfulness out loud. A crucial aspect of conflict resolution, just as in Buddhist practice itself, is discriminating between our interpretations and opinions of an event and how the event was or is personally experienced. In part, this means not making general statements, but rather sticking to the particulars of actual situations and the emotions experienced. It is extremely difficult to have mutual understanding when discussion remains on the level of interpretation and generalizations. 2. Being heard. It is important that everyone be given an opportunity to be fully heard. This means that everyone be given a chance to recount how they remember the history of a conflict, to state their feelings regarding the conflict, and to explain the goals they have for its resolution. Such statements should be neither defensive nor critical, since both approaches tend to preclude deeper mutual understanding. Much conflict arises and is perpetuated through a lack of mutual understanding. Taking calm, deliberate, and adequate time to listen to each other is often all that is needed in reconciliation to begin. So being heard. But it doesn't say here, be a good listener. The principle is being heard. That means, it kind of implies that the other person's listening, but it's a higher order than just the other person listening. It means the person who's listening understands you, and you know they understand. And so sometimes they have this process of explaining back what you heard, and it's really valuable because then if you misunderstood the person has a chance to correct you. And if they understood you, then there's a kind of a relief. Wow, yeah, they understand me. Now at least they understand where I'm coming from. It has an added value sometimes if one of the parties repeats back what they hear, they sometimes can empathize more deeply. They can almost kind of feel the other person's position at times. So giving time to be heard. And I've been on the ethics committee at a number of different communities. And I've been not a party to conflict, but I've been part of one of the people kind of facilitated to help kind of deal with interpersonal conflicts. And I've seen people come to a community with agreements. And maybe the person was a little bit unusual, the person who had the grievance, kind of an unusual, kind of original kind of person. And so it was kind of easy to want to dismiss the person. And I've seen them being dismissed, saying, oh, it's not really a problem, or, you know, we've dealt with it, you know, or just kind of very simply. And I've seen their pain of the person in the grievance get stronger and stronger because they weren't met with properly. They weren't heard. And people thought, oh, just kind of let's get this person out of here somehow. And I've seen even when the person is off, the person with the grievance, it's occasionally it happens, that somehow they've completely, you know, if someone can sit down with them and really listen to them so they feel that they were heard and understood, sometimes the pressure that's in the grievance dissipates. And I've seen situations where other people were dismissive, where I've sat down and met with them, and they really felt heard, and they didn't feel anymore a need to pursue the grievance. They were happy someone heard them and understood their situation. And when they didn't, it just kind of like built for them. Oh, then, there's number 3. I've already covered that. Restating what was heard. To ensure that everyone understands one another, it is useful for each party to briefly restate what the other has said, highlighting the main points. The other party then says whether the restatement is complete and accurate, and if need be, makes corrections. And here comes the religious. This is all kind of, you know, there's nothing particularly spiritual here. Just, this is good stuff, right? But here, this next one could be called maybe more spiritual. So put on your seatbelts so that you don't kind of bolt for the door right away, or, you know, and keep your ears open. You know, some of you might just close your ears as soon as you hear this one. So number 4 is confession. Ooh. Resolution and reconciliation is greatly facilitated if everyone involved reflects on how they may have contributed to a conflict and then explains this to the other party. Even when one person is primarily responsible, self-reflection, confession, and apology on everyone's part can provide a safer, more trusting and understanding environment for everyone to be truthful. Within reason, right? You know, if someone has just physically beat you up, you know, probably doesn't make sense to apologize then or confess then, but so within reason. But you might consider that somehow, offer a kind of, maybe you don't want to call it confession, but offer, you know, some kind of apology or some kind of recognition of your part. And then five and six, five is facilitation. So sometimes it's useful to invite one or more neutral witnesses or mediators to take part in a session of conflict resolution. Such a person may simply be a silent witness, providing a sense of calm and presence, or maybe an active mediator who helps ensure that each person is given uninterrupted opportunities to speak. This person might also point out the difference between statements of opinion and interpretation and direct statements of how an event or feeling was or is actually experienced. And the last one is seeking advice. So if all those things don't work, then sometimes it's good to get advice. Go find someone who you trust and you value their wisdom and ask them to explain your difficulties you have with them. And so like here at IMC, we have a committee that no one knows about, hardly, and has never been used. it's very convenient when you don't tell anyone. It's called the Ethics and Reconciliation Council. And the acronym is EAR, the EAR Council, because it listens. Its first job is to listen. So if there's conflict in our community, it's a place to go for confidential advice. Someone can hear you. You know, someone you can be a sounding board for you. And then they might make advice and suggestions try to be helpful in some way. And Ethics and Reconciliation Council. It's documented online. And Cheryl is one of the people on that committee, right? So she's right there. So now, so you either want to rush out the door right away when it's over, or stay there and wait for the line. And I don't know who else. Jim Podolsky is also on it. He's usually here, but not here. And Mick Bennett are the three members of the community here on it. All very good people. And I think a really good counsel to give. So I'm not saying this because we currently have any problems that I know of. In part, I give this talk today because conflict is on my mind, because in a different community I'm a part of, I feel like I'm in conflict with people there. And so partly this talk was a pep talk to myself. So don't assume that I have it all made. You know, I know how to do it all. It's a process of learning for me. And, you know, to say, oh, it's an opportunity to engage in conflict and learn from it, is a painful thing to hear sometimes. And if someone tells me that right now in the conflict I'm in, I feel, yes, but. But it is. And that doesn't make me quite happy yet, but I hope it does. Eventually. And so the last thing I want to say is that my real hope for a Buddhist community like ours is that we are a community that never turns away from anybody or never closes the door to anybody. So no matter what the conflict is or what the difficulty is that might arise, this is a place where it's safe to be in conflict. This is a place where it's safe because no one's going to throw you out. No one's going to, well, I can't speak for all the people who come here, right? But as an institution, as a group, that my hope, our group value, is that we are never going to turn away from someone that we're in conflict with or difficulty with. And so we have this EAR Council that can help, and certainly I'll try to help, and other people. But if someone has difficulty here within our community, I hope it's a value of our people here, our community, that we'll hang in there and try to work it out and try to find common ground, and that it's a safe place to be in conflict. And I think it's one of the contributions we might be able to give our society is to create like a refuge, a sanctuary. It used to be like in Europe that churches were sanctuaries. If you, you know, did some, if you robbed the bank and you know, if you got to the church, then the king couldn't come and get you as long as you stayed there. And so I don't think we should be that kind of refuge. But I hope that we're a refuge where it feels like, even though there might be conflict here, that it feels safe to come here and engage in it. And if you can't figure out how to do it on your own, that you you know, find that there are community members here, wise people who will help you. So we have 5 minutes before the end. Does anyone want to say, Dick?
We're trying to form a co-housing community, which means like forming another group, and we can anticipate at some point or other there will be conflicts.
And sooner rather probably than later.
It's a very appropriate timing for to have a talk like this now.
Oh, great.
So for not only us who are involved in that, but everybody else as well, right?
Great. So hopefully there's no problems yet. But it's right. I think when anybody lives together in a co-housing community, you're kind of living together, you can expect sooner or later to have conflict. And so it's nice to have an intentional community like that. It's nice to have ground rules ahead of time to prepare for that, rather than assume it's never happened to us, we're Buddhists. It's actually to prepare for it and let some ground rules. And that's the same true in relationships, like with a spouse or for, you know, different situations. It's a time when everything's happy and calm. Well, then it's easy to deny. Well, then we don't have any problems. And then when there's tension, well, then we can't talk about it because it's tense. And so we'll wait until things get calm, and well, then there's no problems. But anyway, you wait until things are calm and nice, and then you say, you know, I notice every once in a while we have these blow-ups or these difficulties. How about if we kind of plan ahead a little bit and establish some ground rules or some procedures, some way to be together? Because to try to do that in the heat of the moment might be asking too much. But if you prepare, and it could be as simple as saying, you know, when one of us gets really angry at the other, how about if we create a 5-minute rule? That we just kind of say, okay, we're instituting the 5-minute rule, no one talks for 5 minutes. And we just kind of spend a time, reflect, cool out, and then after those 5 minutes, let's have a conversation. That could be a ground rule that, you know, you establish. There are many things that can be done. Anyway, thank you. Someone else want to say something or ask a question? The light's on. I see it. Yeah, there you go.
I hate conflict.
Yes.
I've gotten really good at avoiding it. I feel like sometimes I'm that guy in Toy Story, the dinosaur that goes, I can't stand confrontation, because it's just so scary and it makes me feel out of control sometimes. But, you know, if there's anything good about it, it makes me more real about myself. It really helps me see myself in it.
The conflict does?
Yes.
Yes.
It really does. Because I can, you know, get sort of in a euphoric state of spirituality, you know what I mean, where conflictlessness gives me an unreal view of myself, and then I get into a situation where it comes up and my anger comes up or my response to something, and I just go, oh. So in that way, it really does deepen my understanding.
Great, thank you. And the last thing I'll say is, again, it's a plug for regular meditation practice. Regular meditation practice can give you the skills and also some modicum of calm where then it's easier to go into conflict resolution. And the first one, I think is the most important. Calm is important, but the skills, the personal skills, is personal understanding, to understand how we react, to begin having a different relationship to our reactivity, to be able to see it arise, to not be in conflict with our own reactivity, to see our anger and not be in conflict with it, and to let it be there, learn how to feel it in the body, learn how to breathe when we're angry. Meditation can teach you a lot of skills. And so you bring those skills with you to the situation. So, yes.
I just wanted to say that I'm retired now, but I've worked in schools, and schools always have a conflict resolution team for kids to solve their problems, which probably never existed when many of us were in school. And I've often felt so envious that they have that opportunity, because I wish that I had been in school and had been forced to take a conflict resolution course and learn all the skills that are involved in doing that, and also that therefore all my peers also had mm-hmm. the same kind of obligatory experience, and therefore when a conflict arises, we both know here's a conflict, here are some of the things we can do, here's how to get out of it. And so I'm saying that because I think it's wonderful that IMC has such a committee. Unfortunately, it isn't used. I'm sure there must be sometimes some conflicts. But it would be nice. I still think in my life, I would love to take some kind of a course in how to deal with conflict when it arises, since it does arise. Even for a retired person like myself, it arises. You know, there's all kinds of places in which it arises. And lots of us don't really have a clue. You gave a general outline, but, you know, really know in detail. How do you really use in detail on the moment when you're feeling, what was just said? Now, that just makes my blood boil. And I either have to walk away, or I'm going to say something awful, or get into a long argument, which I want to avoid, blah, blah. It would be great to have some opportunity to, you know, really learn and practice skills of dealing with conflict.
Great.
That maybe the IMC could provide.
Yeah, so maybe I'll think about it to see what... I think you're right. I think it would be great to offer it here. It's great to, there's other places that offer it. And it's never too late to learn. I kind of counseled someone many years ago who was dying. And I was gone away for a few weeks. And I kind of thought maybe he was going to die while I was gone. And I came back and I went to his house and all the curtains were drawn. And I said, oh... And I knocked on the door. You know, he couldn't go anywhere because he was kind of, you know, in a bed in the living room. So I knocked on the door and there was no answer. And when I left him, he was really in bed. He was kind of bedridden. He couldn't really get out. He was kind of a little bit delirious. And I thought he was going to die really soon. So I came back from being gone for a few weeks and I knocked on the door to see if he was still alive and say hello. And no one answered the door. And I looked at the curtains. They were drawn again. And I said, oh, that's too bad. I came too late. And so I stood there for a little bit longer, and suddenly the door opened up and he was standing there. Gil, so nice to see you. And I felt like I was looking at a ghost because he said, come on in. Somehow he had kind of revived. I think he had changed the medication a little bit he was on. And he was still dying, but he was revived. But so he came in, and then within 2 minutes of being in his house, he said, you have to help me with my wife. We're fighting. You know, here he was, you know, the last days, weeks of his life, and he was in marital conflict. And I go, what? You know, I didn't say it out loud. because sometimes I don't have that much life experience, so that was a new one for me. I kind of assumed that that close to death, that everything's forgiven and, you know, whatever. But it isn't. And so you never know when you're going to need your skills. So it's good to be prepared. No, thank you very much.